Good morning. Thank you for being here, members and visitors alike. Visitors, we're honored with your presence. Members, over the last couple of months or so, have gotten used to my impressions of the book of Daniel. And we actually spent quite a bit of time in Daniel, detailing all the parallels between Daniel's life and Jesus' life, and Daniel's work and Jesus' work. And those members who were here for most or all of those lessons are kind of snickering a little bit and say, I know what this sermon's about. I can see what's going on here. Hal wanted to do a sermon on Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego during this series and somehow make it parallel to Peter, James, and John, and he couldn't make it work. And so he didn't want to throw out all of his notes, and so he decided to preach it anyway. To which I say, that's only partly true. The real reason I wanted to preach this sermon is to answer a question that I have been asking myself as long as I've been reading the Bible. If you haven't already turned to Daniel chapter 3, you might go ahead and do so at this point. Most of you are aware of the book of Daniel and how it works, especially the first half of the book. Daniel is writing this story largely of his own life, and Daniel is an example to us and a larger than life figure of faith, almost someone who is just a true example to us. And he's absent; he's not here in chapter 3. And, you know, why? That's the question we always want to ask. Why is it when this great challenge to the faith of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is given, and presumably they are the only ones who are willing to defy the king's order, that would seem to exclude Daniel also. Well, why isn't Daniel putting up a fuss about this? I mean, it's kind of unthinkable that Daniel would succumb to this temptation. He's already demonstrated his connection to God, his devotion to God in chapter 1 and 2. He's going to do it again in chapters 4 and 5. He's going to go through his own trial of faith and commitment in chapter 6 with the lion's den. We know that story as well. It's just kind of unthinkable that Daniel would give in and worship when he's told to worship in defiance of the will of God. So we just don't, we feel like we cannot get to that point. And yet, there's no other explanation given to us here. And there have been all kinds of fanciful kind of things that are thrown out there. I remember reading storybooks when I was a kid saying, Daniel's probably out of town on business with the king. And I remember reading that and thinking, that's just crazy. You know, how can you possibly get that out of, well, you can't get that out of the text. It's just not there. Maybe that's what he was doing. But that's not what the text says. I would like to suggest to you here, not only am I confident what is happening with Daniel in this particular point in his life, but I can defend it from the Bible. And it's one of those things where you've read something 100 times and you look at it the 101st time and think, why in the world did I not see that before? And you may very well have beaten me to the punch on this. And if you have, then God bless you for that. I wish you had taught me earlier than in my 50s. But nevertheless, the Bible, I believe, tells us what's going on with Daniel, and I'd like to share it with you. If you know the story, in Daniel chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar is going to set up this great image. The text says in verse number 1, it's 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide. That's roughly 90 feet tall, 9 feet wide, which is not, the critics will jump on that and say, that's not architecturally sound. And the response to that is, this is the man that built the Hanging Gardens. I'm sure he could figure out a way to keep a statue upright if he really wanted to. That being the case, it's put up in the plain of Dura here in the province of Babylon, and people are required to worship, and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego don't. Go back a little bit with me. After the events of chapter 2, and really going back to chapter 1, Daniel and his friends have distinguished themselves as these forced immigrants from Judea, in Nebuchadnezzar's court, and Daniel in particular, and they are all given positions of prominence. The text says, and notice the language of the text, in verse number 49, at the end of chapter 2, and Daniel made a request to the king, and he, the king, that is, appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the administration of the province of Babylon. Note that phrase. We'll come back to that in a second. While Daniel was at the king's court. Now, notice here, the province of Babylon is distinguished from the king's court. The king's court, of course, is in the city of Babylon. I'm going to suggest to you that the city of Babylon and the province of Babylon are not the same thing. And I can suggest to you with evidence from the text. I think the province of Babylon, rather, is probably more like the suburbs or the countryside, something like that, outside of the city limits. To back that up, you'll notice in when the image is set up, in verse number 1 of chapter 3, it's set up on the plain of Dura. Notice this again, in the province of Babylon. Now, a plain is of an indistinct size, of course. But you know what a plain is. You know, a couple of summers ago, I visited West Texas. Okay, it's all plain. You know, it's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of square miles of plain. Nothing but plain. This flat, open area where presumably it'd be pretty easy to see a 90-foot image. And anybody within visual scope of this, and that's probably why it's so big, anybody who was within view of this image, who could hear the music was playing occasionally in conjunction with this image, was supposed to bow down and worship. This clearly is taking place outside of the city limits, which is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's province. They have responsibility in the province. Daniel has responsibility in the king's court. So long story short, Daniel doesn't get into trouble in Daniel chapter 3 because Daniel isn't there. He's doing what he normally did, presumably, and there's no reason to think that anybody in the city of Babylon would have been caught up in this. This is a loyalty check, essentially, here. Nebuchadnezzar is checking to see if these people in his area are willing to submit to him, are willing to give in to his rule, and it turns out that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were not. And that's what I had to say this morning. And I suppose I could make this a 7-minute sermon and send everybody home for an early lunch. But those of you who are members here and have listened to me preach for 6 years know that's not very likely. So while we're here, let's talk a little bit about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And let's talk about this trial that they face and the trial that we face also as we face our own versions of the fiery furnace. And I'd like to give you some takeaways here for this lesson. And the first one is this, that fake worship of idols is still worship of idols. That if you are, quote unquote, going through the motions of serving the devil, of serving some foreign god, of rebelling against God, but your heart isn't really in it, your heart's still for God, but your body is doing things for somebody else, that fake worship still counts. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is a great example of this. An example of not doing it, that is to say. Again, I suggest to you that this is basically a loyalty exercise that Nebuchadnezzar is asking his people to go through. And I've, when we've gone through this this passage in other contexts before, I've made the point, and I'll make it here again, that I believe that there is a distinction between the tone of voice that we see in Nebuchadnezzar in verse number 19, where he's filled with wrath, and his facial expression was altered, New American Standard Bible says, towards Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I see a difference there between that rage and the rage that we see in verse number 12, where after Nebuchadnezzar realizes that these three Hebrews have not given themselves to his image, then he's enraged about that too. I think that we're talking about two different rages here, and that's why his expression changes. This idea of idol worship or image worship, and a lot of scholars think that this is basically an image of Nebuchadnezzar, or is supposed to be anyway. This is intended to help the people there in the province connect and be seen to connect to Nebuchadnezzar. And by going through this process, they're basically acknowledging fealty to the idol and to the emperor who is behind the idol. The idea of idol worship in the emperor's name is an image that's going to come up in Revelation also. There's a lot of parallel between Daniel and Revelation, of course, as you're probably aware. That same kind of idea of emperor worship and going through the motions comes up in Revelation also. The emperor wants you to worship him. We all know this is silly. We all know there's no point to this. But he wants you to do it. And if you don't do it, you're going to get in a lot of trouble. So go ahead and do it. Go ahead and go through the motions. And then you can get back about your life. And the emperor will leave you alone and you won't get in any trouble. That's probably very similar to what's happening here in Daniel chapter 3. This is not an effort to trap some of his closest associates. This is not a ferreting. This is not a mole hunt. He's not trying to find some kind of problem within his administration. And when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego don't go along, he's upset at the situation more than he's upset at the young men. And he calls them in. And we read this text a few moments ago. And explains to them what's going to happen. Look, I appreciate your faith and your commitment, and your God does tremendous things. We talked about that back before with Daniel. We understand this. But here's the reality of the situation. The reality of the situation is we're going to have to get this done. And maybe you've had a boss or some other authority figure who tried to use this kind of logic to get you to compromise your faith at some point. It's not uncommon at all. Well, look, I appreciate where you're coming from, but this is the reality of the situation. We're going to have to do this. And if you don't do this, I have no choice. My hands are tied in this matter. I cannot humiliate myself. I cannot embarrass myself like this and allow a close representative of mine to defy my orders like this. You're going to have to go in the fiery furnace just like I said people are going to go in the fiery furnace. And no offense to your God, he's not going to get you out of this. The only one who's going to get you out of this is me. And that's when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego have this tremendous gesture of faith. And we'll read it again in verse number 10 and following. They replied to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Well, now we're talking about an entirely different situation. Now we have out-and-out abject rebellion against the emperor. And this is something Nebuchadnezzar absolutely will not tolerate. Now he's legitimately angry. This is defying his order. He fires up the furnace 7 times its normal heat. He is determined now to make an example out of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego because they refuse to go through the motions. They refuse to pretend that they're an emperor worshiper, that they're an idol worshiper. They're not going to do it. Because they understand a principle that sometimes we forget. That going through the motions in service to evil dishonors God. It shows us to be at least pretending to be something that we claim not to be. The only one who is truly worthy of worship is the God of heaven. And we as his followers, we as his devotees, acknowledge that and we proudly admit that and preach that. That's what we're supposed to be doing anyway. Him only thou shalt serve. Moses told the people in Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 13. Jesus quotes this to the devil, remember, in the temptation in Matthew chapter 4 verse 10, where the devil has asked him to bow down and worship. And he says, "You shall serve the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve." Jesus understood that. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego understood that as well. We give the impression, or should give the impression, that we are faithful. We want to be perceived as being faithful. Now, granted, being faithful, allowing yourself to God, is going to occasionally come with consequences. There are going to be problems with that. Jesus told us that. We didn't buy a pig and a poke with this. Jesus told us up front. There are going to be problems in your life when you acknowledge me first and foremost. When you come to the kingdom of God and put the kingdom first in your life, other things will suffer. You will suffer from time to time. It'll be worth it, he says. It'll be more than worth it, but you will suffer. Our job is not simply to be faithful in these times, but to be perceived as being faithful. We need both. Jesus talks to these besieged Christians in Asia in Revelation chapter 2, verse 10, talking about the trials that they're going through, and the greater trials are yet to come. And he says, "Be faithful unto death," or "until death," depending on your translation. "Push through this," he says, "and I will give you the crown." This is the assurance of the one who is found faithful in all things, And again, the parallels between Daniel and Revelation are profound here. The brethren in Asia also have an opportunity to just kind of go through the motions, pretend worship. And then after all, we'll get to live, we'll get to do business, we'll get to pay our bills, we'll get to feed our family. Surely that's a good thing. God wants us to do these things. We'll be more faithful to God alive than dead. And this vision before the throne of God in chapter 6 puts the light of that. Chapter 5, rather. As these faithful souls who have been martyred cry out before the Lord, still honoring Him. Faithful unto death. That's the message that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego get across to us. To continue to be found faithful by not just God, but also our neighbors. How does that work for us? How might we go through the motions today? I think that we can go through the motions in the same sort of way by passively accepting this sinful world that we're in. And by that, I don't mean that our job is to go out and fix the world. That's not what I'm saying. My point is that it is very easy when we are surrounded by these sinful influences, when we're surrounded by these factors that are beyond our control and beyond our comprehension, and just they overwhelm us, to simply throw up our hands and say, I guess this is just the world we're living in. I guess there's nothing I can do about this. Well, as far as changing the world, maybe not. But you can change your part of the world. You can be faithful in your part of the world. You can distinguish yourself from the world. And I think that's probably the problem. We would rather blend in. We would rather fit in. We would rather just kind of go through the motions. We're not saying it's good that sin runs rampant, but there's no need to make a big deal about it. There's no need to embarrass ourselves, to damage our relationships, to damage our prospects for the future. And we forget why we're Christians in the first place. We are not Christians simply to be different in our hearts, but to make an impact, at some level at least, on the world that's around us. Ephesians chapter 5, verse number 11, one of the many passages that deals with this. Do not participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but instead even expose them. It's disgraceful to do these things, he goes on to say in verse number 12. Don't participate at all. And then go to the next step. Expose them. See, that's what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did. Their faithfulness exposes the hypocrisy in all of this. And they stand as an example to us thousands of years later that we also cannot simply sit by and let sin happen. We have to stand apart. We have to be seen standing apart. Fellowship with false doctrine and disciples also. Well, what are you going to do? Now, who knows what a Christian is these days? Everybody and his brothers call themselves a Christian. And the world's clearly lost its distinction between those who are Christians and those who are not. Maybe it'd be better for us just to accept the world's terminology, accept the world's definitions, accept the world's boundaries or lack thereof, and just kind of go with the flow. Well, the text says, and it says repeatedly, that we as the faithful children of God are required to stand apart from those who are not faithful, including those who claim to be faithful but claim incorrectly. 2 John verse 9 and 10 talks about the one who goes too far, the one who transgresses, does not abide in the teaching of God, of Christ. He who does not have God, the text says. He's gone too far. He's exceeded his authority. And he has no relationship with God anymore because he is no longer under the auspices of Jesus Christ. We have to take that same stand that John tells his readers to take. The same one that Jude tells his readers to take. To defend the gospel that was once for all delivered to the saints. Same one that Paul tells his readers to take in Galatians 1 verse 6 and following through verse 9. Anyone who preaches any other gospel that you've preached, he's accursed. He's anathema. There's only one gospel. And we have to be prepared to defend that one gospel, including against those who would claim to be believers. It's not enough for us to simply be different. We have to be seen to be different. And I realize that can be embarrassing. The nail that sticks out of the board is the one that gets hammered. We understand that. None of us likes getting hammered. I certainly don't. But if this is what the Lord requires of us, to set ourselves apart as God has set us apart in Jesus, then surely we must be prepared to do that as well. And by the way, let me point this out before we move on. Fake worship does not count with regard to the true God. There's an interesting little drama given to us in the little short book of Haggai in the Minor Prophets, where Haggai is told to go to the priests and have this experiment with regard to holy things. Go to the priest and get a ruling on this. He said, put some sanctified food in a cloak of a garment, touch something that's unclean, and does that make it clean? And the priest said, no, it doesn't make it clean. That's not the way it works. Well, take something that's unclean and touch something that is clean. Does that make the clean thing unclean? Yes, it does. And God's point, of course, is that dirtiness, filthiness, sin transfers a lot easier than holiness does. It's a lot easier to do the right thing wrong. It's impossible to do the wrong thing right. If you are worshiping God, then God bless you for that. But mailing it into the true God is going to be seen as every bit as much of a compromise as mailing it into the false God is. God requires us to worship Him in spirit and in truth. And we see this over and over again, 1 Corinthians 14, verse 15, and other passages as well. When we give our service to God, to the one true God, we have to make sure that we are giving that from our heart, that we are truly and nobly and with our love and with our commitment, with our true faith, giving ourselves to Him. Point number two. Commitment is independent of results. I think that we have a lot of Christians who would be perfectly willing to go into the furnace of fire, would go into the furnace of fire in our heartbeat. If they had some kind of reasonable assurance from God, they would not get hurt. If it will not hurt me, yes, absolutely, I'll go in. And God, if you can just kind of sign it at the bottom of the page there, yes, I will commit myself to the fire furnace. Because Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did it, and they weren't hurt. And if I'm not going to be hurt, then I'll go ahead and do it too. That's not the way this works. And that's not the way that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego presented it either. You'll notice. They said, we believe in God, and we know that our God can save us. And if He's determined to save us, He will save us. But we also acknowledge the possibility that He won't. And if He won't, and if we die in this fiery furnace, we're going to die as believers in the one true God. The commitment they had to God had nothing to do with whether they did or did not survive this experience. They were going to be faithful regardless of what happened. We will not bow down to your image. In the book of Job, Satan makes a charge against Job that actually has some foundation. He's got a point. The book of Job, of course, is about this servant of God named Job, who is tremendously wealthy and has basically everything that a person of his time could possibly want. Riches and children and family, and it's just going great for Job. Because he's being blessed by God, and he's being blessed by God because he loves the Lord. And when the devil calls him on this in the throne of heaven, which in the scene that we cannot fully explain, Satan makes this charge against Job. He says, have you not built a hedge around him? Which is to say, basically, well, why wouldn't Job serve God? Look what you've done for him. If he were to reject God, you might take away his hedge. You might take away all these things that you've given him. If I were in Job's position, I'd worship God too. Now you take away the hedge. That's a different story. When you find out the answer to the question that really the entire book of Job is about, does Job serve God for nothing? That's what Satan asks, and that's what the book of Job is all about. Does Job serve God for nothing? What will happen if God gives you absolutely nothing in this life? Will you still serve him? Now, I'm not sure that that is a reasonable hypothetical question to ask. Because God will still give things to Job, as far as that goes. He still gave him air to breathe, and presumably food and water, and things of that nature. Maybe Job wished he wouldn't in situations like that. We'll never be completely cut off in this life from the blessings of God. Does Hal serve God for nothing? Do you serve God for nothing? That's the question. We can serve God if it's easy. We can serve God if we are promised that the fiery furnace will not hurt us. That's easy. The question is, what will we do if we think that very possibly, or even likely, or even certainly, the furnace will hurt us? That's when faith comes in. That's your Abraham and Isaac moment. God almost sounds like he's taunting Abraham a little bit with the language. You remember the story in Genesis 22, right? First couple of verses. Take your son. Right? You feel connected to your son? I don't have a son. I have daughters, but I understand the concept. Take your son. Your only son. Whom you love. And go kill him. Well, God, that's not reasonable. That's not fair. I can mount any number of logical and theological arguments to argue that, in fact, that is a poor idea. I should not do that. And many scholars have over the years. Or you can do what Abraham did. Say, God will work this out. I don't know how. We learn from Hebrews chapter 11 that he thought that God would probably raise Isaac from the dead. That's probably how this would work out. Which is a remarkable thing because Abraham had never heard of anybody being raised from the dead at that point. Not a single soul had ever been raised from the dead. He hadn't read the Lazarus story yet. God will work it out. We'll do this. We'll do what God told us to do. And God will work it out. He had enough faith to do that. He went into the fiery furnace not knowing what was going to happen. Only that God was going to be in charge. And that God was going to take care of it. That's what we have to do. Well, pardon the expression, how would we hedge our bets today? How might we negotiate with regard to the fiery furnace in our own lives today? Well, I'd suggest to you that some people will try to ignore what you might call hot button issues. Issues of controversy. Things that will stir things up. Preachers are like this. Timothy, perhaps, was in danger of being like this. Maybe this is why Paul wrote like he did in 1 Timothy chapter 6. And go all the way back to verse number 1. Let's start in verse number 3. If anyone advocates a different doctrine and does not agree with sound words, those of our Lord Jesus Christ, very similar to what we were referring to back in Galatians, remember, and with a doctrine conforming to godliness, he is conceited and understands nothing, but he has a morbid interest in controversial questions and disputes about words, out of which arise envy, strife, abusive language, evil suspicions, and constant friction between men of depraved mind and deprived of the truth who suppose that godliness is a means of gain. Now, there have been people like this in the Lord's church ever since the beginning. Clearly they were in Paul's day. They continue to exist today. And the easiest way to get by in the short term in situations like this is like pretend it's not true. You know, let's just, as some of my preaching colleagues like to say, observe the Passover on things like that. We'll just kind of ignore that. We'll just kind of let that go. And, God will sort it all out in due time. And the parable of the tares in the field is taken out of context here. You know, it's not our job to weed out the field. God will weed out the field. We'll just kind of do our own thing and not really give ourselves to the whole truth, because it's going to get some people angry, it's going to drive some people off, it's going to harm the church or harm the treasury or whatever it happens to be. That's not what true commitment does. True commitment gives himself or herself to the things of God wholeheartedly and then deals with whatever kind of results come out. This is what I like to call process thinking versus results thinking. You believe in the process. The process is you serve God. The process is you believe the Bible. You do what the Bible says. The results will take care of themselves. They may in the short term be bad. They may be good, whatever. I'm not going to get caught up in short term results, though. I'm worried about long term results. Results beyond my control, beyond my vision. And I believe in the process. I believe the process will, in the long term, get me the results I want. So I will stick with the process no matter what. Even if it's a total disaster, I'm going to stick with the process because God knows what He's doing better than me. We go into the furnace of fire and trust that God will work it out. Whitewashing the truth's negative impact, kind of similarly along these lines. Talked about buying a pig and a poke before. This is some people's idea of evangelism. Just get them in the water, get them all wet, and then we'll worry about it later. And I know I'm not suggesting here that you have to know absolutely everything about every aspect of the gospel before you're baptized. I wouldn't be baptized yet if that were the case. Nor would you. What we're saying is that Jesus, over and over again, told his disciples about the downside, about the negative aspects, and warned them using the parable of the king going to the war and the man building a tower in Luke chapter 14, verse number 28. Count the cost. Realize what you're getting into before you sign up for my army. The hours are long. The work is hard. The enemies are multitudinous. The retirement plan is great. You're going to love that. But in the short term, it's going to hurt. From time to time, it's going to hurt a lot. That being the case, you follow after me. Again, in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 3 and 4. For the time will come when they, that is, the people who listen to what you have to say, they will not endure sound doctrine, but wanting to have their ears tickled, they will accumulate for themselves teachers in accordance to their own desires and will turn away their ears from the truth and will turn aside to myths. That's what a lot of people will do. And the formula for success among preachers that I've heard oftentimes, short-term success anyway, is don't preach anything dangerous. Don't make anybody mad. Don't make any enemies. Just kind of walk down the middle of the road. Talk about a lot of happy things. Make a lot of friends. Don't ruffle any feathers. You preach there for 50 years. And it's probably true. In a lot of places, at least. But whether it is or is not true, that's not the preacher's job. That's not Timothy's job. That's not Paul's job. It's not my job. Our job is to preach the word. And when that is uncomfortable for certain ones, that's not a problem with the preacher. That's not a problem with the gospel. That's a problem with the hearer. And we need to continue to do what God has told us to do. Accepting half a loaf without comment. And what I mean by that is, let me put it this way. I believe, I've done this for the better part of 30 years now, full time. And I believe now, looking back at a life of preaching that has had its ups and downs, certainly. I'm not trying to make this sound like I'm some kind of hero or something, because I'm not. But I think that I've probably gotten myself in trouble more than anything else because I expected people to grow. In fact, I really kind of insisted on it. And I got annoyed when people didn't. And in times past, I've been impatient about that. I've been maybe even rude about that. I like to think that I've grown. I think that I've matured in certain areas. But the basic concept of expecting that Christians would be better and stronger and more faithful next year than they were last year, I will take that to my grave. That is what we must do as Christians. And that is not what all Christians do. Jesus says in Luke chapter 9, verse 62, the one who puts his hand in the plow and turns back is not fit for the kingdom of God. And there are many other expressions of commitment that Jesus uses in his ministry that urge us to get the most out of ourselves and to encourage others to try to do the same. And to reject this notion that being better than somebody else, or even better than we used to be, is good enough. I don't want this to sound discouraging at all, but I'll tell you the truth on this. It's never good enough. There is always upside. There is always improvement. There is always growth. And if you're like me, you find that to be tremendously exciting and encouraging. The idea that you can know more about the Bible, you can know more about God's will for your life, even be closer to Him than you are today. I want that. Don't you want that? Shouldn't we crave getting more out of our faith than we have right now? And if that is the case, then we cannot allow ourselves to be complacent and simply give ourselves credit for showing up on Sunday morning and maybe even Sunday night. And that's a major backpack on that one. Well, God bless you for being here on Sunday morning. But if you can do better, I urge you to try to want to do better in the first place, and then try to do better. Because there's more for you in this relationship with Jesus Christ than you have yet plumbed. More than I have. Being truly committed means pushing ourselves to the next limit. One more point, then we'll close up. Respecting God is not equal to serving Him. The relationship between Nebuchadnezzar and the God of heaven is a strange one. It's the text alludes to it occasionally. It's I fail to believe that Nebuchadnezzar is in any way a real disciple of God. It just doesn't seem to fit. Now, Nebuchadnezzar says a lot of really good things in the text, including in our text. In chapter 3, as we said before, Daniel chapter 3, verse number 29, Nebuchadnezzar here responding after the event, after Nebuchadnezzar has seen the amazing deliverance of the three Hebrews. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses reduced to a rubbish heap, inasmuch as there is no other God who is able to deliver in this way. That's a tremendous thing for Nebuchadnezzar to say. It could have been better. It could have been a lot better. What if, hypothetically, instead of saying the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, he'd said my God? That'd be a very different kind of statement, wouldn't it? I don't know why he didn't say that. I'm sure that Nebuchadnezzar, like most everybody else in this time, believed in a plurality of deities. He was willing to acknowledge the existence of God, and even the power of God, but that didn't mean that he had to give up his own God or gods. Their God is great. Don't say anything against his God. But that is not the same thing as true acknowledgement. And in fact, Nebuchadnezzar is really kind of good at these kind of things when he doesn't really have a whole lot of choice in the matter. When he gets caught, when he is exposed. When his need for God, his dependence on God, is exposed to himself, to others. That's when he really sounds like a faithful person. Skip ahead to chapter 4, verse number 3. Nebuchadnezzar, chapter 4 is in Nebuchadnezzar's words. And he says of the Most High, how great are his signs, verse 3, and how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. Something very similar at the end of the text. In chapter 4 and verse 34. And following, his dominion is an everlasting dominion, verse 34. And his kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of earth are accounted as nothing, but he does according to his will in the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of earth, and no one can ward off his hand or say to him, what have you done? That sounds like it's out of the Psalms. It sounds like something David would write. But is that the same thing as saying there is only one God? The Lord Jehovah, he is God. It does not seem to be the case. I would argue that he stopped considerably short of being a true devotee, a true worshiper of God in the way that God has always required his people to be. There are people who have come to the Lord from outside. Rahab the harlot, Ruth the Moabitess, and others we could talk about as well, who did not have any root in Abraham and yet found Abraham's faith. In the New Testament, of course, many Gentiles came to the Lord. I don't think Nebuchadnezzar is one of them. We also, I fear, can stop short of true service. We can pat ourselves on the back, tear a rotator cuff doing it, by talking about how better we are than all these atheists, all these heretics, all these agnostics out there who refuse to acknowledge God at all. We'll acknowledge God. We might read his book every once in a while. How great am I? We need to do better than that. Don't wait for a convenient time. Felix was caught. He had no argument against Paul's preaching regarding righteousness and justice, judgment coming. And he was shaken. And as most of us know from reading Acts chapter 24, he said, go your way. And when there's a convenient time, I'll call. Whenever the time is right. Well, the time was right then. And maybe the time was never right after that. We sometimes say that Felix, you know, never had another opportunity, may not have had another. He had plenty of opportunities after this. The text goes on to say he talked to Paul a lot, hoping to get some kind of bribe to get him out of there. But there is not that same urgency. There was a window of opportunity that Felix had. A wicked, wicked man, historians tell us. Man had no regard for morality, certainly had no regard for God, who no doubt got hit right between the eyes with Paul's sermon. He heard exactly what he needed to hear and exactly the moment he needed to hear it. And he refused to act on it. He made up an excuse, waiting for a convenient time. That's what we can do when we find ourselves convicted. And we find ourselves right in the middle of the convenient time. We convince ourselves some other time is going to be better. There is never a better time than right now to do the right thing. Secondly, stop when you get tired. I'll serve God, and I'll serve God, and then I'll serve God some more, and then I'm going to quit. I'm done. You know, I get a hard time about my lawnmower. I have this self-propelled mower that tends to give out when it gets really hot. When I get really sweaty, it doesn't work quite as well. You know, and I'll push through. And at some point, you know, I could do the backyard too. But when was it? 4 or 5 years ago, something like that. I'm in my mid-40s, and I got a front yard and a backyard, and I cut the front yard. I said, you know what? I'm good. Maybe I'll come back to the backyard tomorrow. Maybe we'll do this another day. There's still more work to be done, but I wasn't up to it. And I'm not making excuses for myself. I'm not apologizing. That's the way physical things are. Spiritual things are not like that, though. You can, in fact, find the inner wherewithal to push through and accomplish spiritual duties and spiritual responsibilities no matter where you are. It doesn't matter how big of a breakfast you ate. Doesn't matter how much rest you had the night before. Doesn't matter how good or how bad your parents were. You have the ability to do the right thing. And tomorrow you'll still have it. Do not grow weary in well-doing, Paul says in Galatians 6, verse 9. For we will reap if we do not faint, if we do not quit. And we'll keep this up. Push through. Find that inner source of strength and find it in God. You can and you will succeed. If you just work for God until you get tired, that's not going to get the job done. God expects and God deserves, friend, more than that. Get caught up in mundane affairs. You know, there's a difference between the way the Lord speaks of the people who are typified by the wayside soil and the people who are typified by the rocky soil. And then, on the other hand, the people who are typified by the weedy soil. There's a difference. The seed falls on the wayside soil, which is people who just have no regard for God, no regard for the things of God, and it's done. It's done before it starts. They're rejected. And then it falls on the rocky soil, and it looks like it's going to go pretty well there for a while, but there's no real root there. There's no real commitment there. And that seed dies off too. And then the weedy soil comes along, and the seed that falls in the weedy soil doesn't die. And we think that we've made an improvement. You know, it survived. It grew. It might have grown a little bit at least. It didn't produce very much. It didn't produce very well. It certainly didn't produce what it could have produced. But we're better off than the rocky soil. We're better off than the wayside soil, surely. But is that really the point? Isn't the point that we are supposed to be giving ourselves to God so that He will get the glory and as much of it as possible? Isn't it, in a sense, just as bad to be so cluttered up with the things of this life? And we got a lot of things in this country. In 21st century America, we're doing great. The worst of us is doing great by world standards. And there are so many things on TV, and there's so many sites on the internet, and there's so many games to play, there's so many sports to watch, and on and on and on. We just find ourselves out of time. We can't give ourselves to the Lord as we say we would like. And I said before, I'll say it again. I have ceased to believe in time management problems. There are no time management problems. There are only priorities problems. Everybody has exactly the same amount of time. You have 24 hours today, just like I do. You have 168 hours this week, just like I do. It's not a matter of how much time you have. It's about how you use the time that you have. Are we willing to make the hard choices? Are we willing to cut back on less important things so we can give ourselves to the seed? So we can allow it to turn ourselves into the kind of person that we want to be, that we say we want to be, that God is trying to make us be. How much do we really respect God? Are we going to give Him half service, lip service, say a lot of good things to a lot of good people at the right time? Or are we actually going to dig in and do the work and confess Jesus as our Lord and Savior, not just with our mouth, not just situationally, but with our very lives, every aspect of our life? Saying, "I am thine, O Lord. I have heard thy voice. I surrender all." Not most, not some. I surrender all. That's what God requires of us. And there's going to come a time when we are going to be held accountable for the choices that we make. If your fiery furnace right now seems intimidating, you just wait. It gets a lot worse than this. There's a fiery furnace waiting for the wicked that will never go out. The Bible talks a lot about hell, a lot more than it does about heaven. And it's a terrifying prospect. You don't have to go there. You can go to heaven instead. You can live your life in faith and in hope and in peace and in joy. And then go to heaven after your life is over. If you will give yourself to Jesus Christ, if you'll commit yourself to Him, not just today, but every day of your life, put Him on in baptism, rise up to walk in newness of life. You can do this. And if you need to do this, if your soul is not right with God in this way or in any other way, we urge you to make it right. And if we can help in any way, please allow us to do so at this time while we stand and sing to encourage you.